This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark, here again with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. We have a line open for you right now if you'd like to call 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, along with our calls, some interesting topics to talk over.
Yes, basic training. I know that's been on your mind all day, Tom, all year. You've been thinking about how do we get our soldiers basically trained,
right? Well, it is an important topic.
No, it actually is. But basic training is changing. We may have more Pilates and fewer sit-ups, so it's rather interesting.
Pilates and Army basic training.
Hard to imagine. But, of course, fighting and warfare is different these days. And we're going to talk about the Dutch study of omega-3 fatty acids that were added to margarine. What does it mean for your health? Should you take fish oil or not? Is it relevant?
Mm-hmm. Fish oil. Coming up. Any fish oil in our recipe?
Not at all, but there's corn. It's corn and shrimp pilaf. So I guess there's shrimp oil. Not fish oil, shrimp oil.
Here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health, our medical myth buster later on the hour two. So 800-462-7413, the number if you'd like to call. And here's a listener with us now, Zorba in Buffalo, New York. Hello.
Hello.
What's up?
Well, I had some carpal tunnel surgery in April, and the doctor was very cavalier about it and said, oh, don't worry about a thing. You want to do the other hand. I had my left done first because that's my dominant hand. You can go ahead and do the other one in 2 weeks. And there was no special care, so I was, resting it, trying not to do too much. But it took a very, very long time to heal, much longer than I thought. And then about a month ago, I developed a trigger thumb. And I was kind of aggravated, went back to the doctor, and he said, also very cavalierly, oh, yes, in 25% of the cases after carpal tunnel surgery, you'll develop this condition. But don't worry. There's a surgery for that one, too.
Come on, really?
So I was nervous about doing another one, and I said I would want to wait 3 weeks or so, and then I went home and got all over the Internet. And it turns out there's really not a whole lot to do except surgery, so I'm about to make the appointment today to have it done, and I wanted a second opinion.
I want to talk a little bit about surgery and post-surgery. When you have a surgical procedure, unless there's a real reason to go and have the second limb done, I always say wait until the first limb is finished. Now, for knee surgery, for instance, some people have two knees done because they have terrible arthritis in both knees. They have difficulties with the anesthesia. You have to think long and hard before you're going to have both knees done, and sometimes you do it. But with carpal tunnel, I would not have the other one done until the first one healed. And I'll tell you that from personal experience. I had my carpal tunnel on the right. I was going to have it done on the left. I never did have it done. The one on the right, I had a little complication. It had a little bleeding afterwards. It took me 3 months to get over the pain. And so, if I had the other one done, well, I would have been disabled with both hands. And frankly, as soon as one hand was better and I started using it, the other carpal tunnel symptoms didn't bother me nearly as much.
Well, how about the cavalier attitude about giving information up front? And after the fact,
Awful.
A quarter of the people.
And frankly, I don't know where that data comes from. A quarter of the people get trigger thumb. Did you see that on the Internet? I've never seen it.
No, I did not see anything like that. That's something he volunteered.
That is not a common complication. I doubt if it's 25%. I send people for carpal tunnel surgery all the time. We have neurosurgeons in our group and hand surgeons in our group. They do a marvelous job with carpal tunnel surgery. I do not remember one person in all my time as a physician who had a trigger thumb. So I question this 25% issue.
Maybe it's his data.
Yeah, maybe it's his data. Yeah, that's exactly it. Now, I'll tell you something else. You're not correct about the fact that the only treatment for this is surgery, because quite often with trigger fingers and trigger thumbs, an injection of steroid into an area of the thumb where the trigger actually occurs, where the swelling actually occurs, sometimes can get it to disappear. And you may not need the surgery. This may be a complication of the surgery. You may need a little bit of steroid to go in there, basically, to get it to cool down, and then it may disappear. I mean, I definitely would not have the surgery. Yeah. I'll give you exactly what I think. A, you need a second opinion from another doctor. I wouldn't go back to this guy. I would go to another doctor. Everything you said to me brings up a red flag. Number one, cavalier attitude. Number two, oh, this is a complication 25% of the time. I don't believe that. And number three, come in and I'll do the surgery for that. Well, wait a second. And number four, he wanted to do both surgeries, one surgery, and let's wait 3 weeks and do the other surgery. I don't like the way this sounds to me.
Okay, he was. I talked to so many people, and he was the most recommended surgeon.
Yeah, well, but, well, that's great. You know, maybe the most. And frankly, there are complications with carpal tunnel surgery, but I don't care if they're the most recommended. You went in there, and his attitude was cavalier, right?
Yeah.
Well,
cheerful.
Yeah, I mean, did you like that? Obviously, he wasn't relating to your problems, right?
Only after I gave him the look did I realize that he realized that I was angry.
Yeah, well, yeah. That's the reality is you don't want to get to the point where you're angry. Now,
yeah.
I'm not saying you're not going to go back, and he may not have done a good job with surgery, but I personally would not have a surgery on a trigger thumb after this complication without getting a second opinion. And the second opinion I would want to have from another hand surgeon or a neurosurgeon is, will an injection of steroid get this to settle down? Is this a post-operative complication that just needs to get the swelling down in order to prevent the trigger thumb? That's what you need.
Okay, terrific.
You asked for a second opinion. I just gave it. Good luck
excellent.
To you.
And now I'm going for number three, and then it'll be solved.
Okay. Thanks so
good
much.
Good luck. Let us know
Thank
what happens.
Thank you very Bye-bye. Much.
You often say, Zorba, that chemistry is important when you're having surgery, when you see a doctor, that it matters whether you feel all right about that person.
Absolutely. Well, it's very interesting. I used to have the opinion of, well, the quote, the surgeon is good with their hands. It doesn't matter what their personality is. I no longer believe that. Yeah. I think that if we as a society accept, and if I as a physician accept that somebody can be not nice or mean or nasty because they happen to be technically good, that's not acceptable. That's harassment. You need somebody who you're emotive with and who works with you as a human and is also technically good. That's the right doc.
1-800-462-7413. It's toll free, of course. 800-462-7413. To a caller now, Zorba in Madison, Wisconsin. Hello.
Hi, Zorba. Thanks for having me on the show.
Sure. How can he help you?
Well, I was actually calling about my girlfriend. We've been dating for about 6 months, and I'm not a morning person, so as I'm sort of coming up out of my sleepy stupor in the morning, there's a lot of times I hear this crackling noise, and I eventually wake up enough to look over and see that she's cracking every joint in her fingers, and then she moves to her neck, her shoulders, and her back, and it's loud, and she goes, oh, that feels so good. And I'm thinking, oh, man, it sounds painful. And of course, you know, a lot of people say that this is completely harmless, but I wonder if over the course of 40 or 50 years of cracking joints and knuckles and necks and backs, so whether there's any kind of good effect or bad effect that comes with that.
Oh, I can just see it. So you wonder whether or not 50 years from now she'll look like the Hunchback of Notre Dame, Quasimodo. Well, let me tell you what you're actually doing. When you crack your joint, what you're doing is your joint has fluid in it, and the fluid actually has a variety of gases within the joint. I mean, the gas is there. It's produced metabolically, and when you pull on the joint, you increase the pressure in the joint, and as a result, a gas bubble forms, and that's the sound that you're hearing. You're hearing the sound of a gas bubble exploding inside the joint. Exploding is probably too strong a word, but it really is. You know, it's a bubble that you're actually hearing. It does not cause any harm. It does not cause any derangement at all, and it also really doesn't do anything for the joints at all. Some people just, I think, like to feel like they crack their joints and now they're more limber. And in fact, studies have shown you're not any more limber when you crack your joints. And if you crack the knuckles in your hand, the most common joint, your hands don't get big and hairy by the time you're 50. Yeah.
No, you're looking ahead 40 to 50 years. Is this thing a deal breaker for you?
Of course not.
Well, that's good.
That's good. That makes Tom happy. We're both smiling. Good luck on your relationship. Deal breaker.
Right. Thanks so much. I appreciate the advice.
We appreciate the call. Thanks.
Deal breaker. That's amazing. Is this a deal breaker? Yeah. We wanted to get married. We loved each other, but she cracks her joints. Yeah. And just can't take it anymore.
Adios. So, Zorba, what's this new basic training regimen for the United States Army? Sounds interesting.
Well, it's the regimen and it's the recruits. So let's look at the recruits. The recruits are the recruits are much more overweight. Very interesting data. Between 1995 and 2008, okay, the proportion of potential recruits who failed their physicals because they were overweight rose 70%.
Yeah, that's bad, but it isn't.
Oh, my God, these are 18, 19-year-olds.
I mean, we've been talking about this in the general population for a long time. Oh,
it's outrageous. Yeah. And then we look at the recruits that make it. In other words, the ones that are make it, you know, that are basically fit. If we look at the ones that are make it, you know, who go through some basic fitness, in other words, they didn't fail. If we look back to 2000, in the year 2000, 4% failed a basic fitness test. In other words, they made it through but failed the fitness test. And now it's 20%.
Yeah.
So, in other words, the ones that make it, even though they're not obese and they didn't get in, they're also not very healthy.
Yeah.
So there are a number of issues here that the Army has looked at. If they look at the warfare that they're engaged in Afghanistan, in the Middle East area, the warfare is different from troops marching in Europe, you know, fighting the Jerry's in World War II. Mm-hmm. It's a different type of warfare. And so they looked at basically what are they going to do for this. And now they're developing a totally different program, which is more like what we do for fitness, core fitness, Pilates, not just sit-ups, not marching, you know, for 4 miles or 10 miles, you know, with a 50-mile, you know, with a 50-pound pack, because that's not what they do. You don't actually go on
also,
these
long
marches.
Also, it says they're hurting themselves more. The recruits are in such bad shape that the old kind of regimen was injuring them.
Exactly. And they have 145,000 recruits a year that they train through this basic training. Yeah. Basic training. And what they want to do is they want to harden their bodies. They want to train them. They don't want to injure them. And they want to make sure that they can actually engage in the rigors. And if they're going to go on long marches, for instance, well, they'll do additional training for that particular type of activity.
Yeah. Now, I wonder whether they're kind of slacking off on the training, making it easier, but they say that's not the case.
Well, they haven't eliminated running, but the question is what you want to do. If you're looking for training, you know, there's some cross-benefit from training that you do, but the fact is physical training to do a particular activity, training that activity makes you better. So, for instance, if you're going to do downhill skiing, training with downhill skiing and improving that type of activity with balance means a lot more than jogging for 10 miles. Nobody would say, oh, I'm going to train for downhill skiing and I'm going to jog.
Yeah.
So train for the job. Just like mentally, if you're working on something, you train that. And so I think this is good. And when we look at our armed forces, we want our recruits to be healthy. This is many of them continue in that job for years and years at a time. And it looks like the Army has actually made changes. And they're not known to be the most changeable organization, shall we say?
Keeping up with the times.
Now. Yes, keeping up with the times.
800-462-7413. Toll free, 1-800-462-7413. Let's see now, Zorba, if we can help a listener in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hi.
Hi, Big T Tom. Zorba, hello. How are you?
Fine. Good.
How can we help you?
Well, the reason I'm calling is my main problem is neuropathy, numbness in both feet. I never go barefoot, and the only relief I can find is I use a therapy tub or hot tub. I put my feet on the jets. It provides 2 hours without pain. I do that for about 15 minutes, and I have the most pain in the morning when I get out of bed, and it's too painful to go back to bed. I will put on my special shoes. But I wanted to tell you that I recently bought a computer. I immediately looked up Zorba, and he looks just like I thought he would.
That's a neuropathy talking.
I love your show. I listen regularly. I'm a devoted listener.
Thank you very much. Getting away from my looks, my good and handsome looks that simply attracts. My looks are so good that it attracts people to the radio.
Mine too.
What's the neuropathy from? Diabetic, diabetes?
No,
or?
It's not. I think it could be possibly from a whole lot of stomping.
How long have you had it for?
Maybe 3 to 4 years.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and getting back to stomping, usually neuropathy doesn't come from physical activity. You know, so you know if you're stomping or marching, for instance, like a recruit or other mm-hmm. things, that's rarely a cause from it. But there are a lot of different causes for neuropathy, diabetes being the most common cause. There are vitamin deficiencies that can cause it. Alcohol can cause it. Do you drink a lot of alcohol?
No.
No alcohol at all. Have you gone to somebody to try to make a diagnosis from it? Is this a numbness that you have in your foot,
yes.
or is it tingling?
It is. It has gotten worse to where my right heel is just completely, half of it is completely numb.
Uh-huh. Okay. So do you have trouble walking because you can't?
Oh, yes. I have to wear a special therapeutic shoes with mm-hmm. very much support for my midsole.
For the midsole.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So is it the pain that bothers you now? What's the most difficult symptom that you have?
That is the most difficult. It's the pain. It's too painful.
Uh-huh. Are you on anything at all for that?
Gabapentin.
How much?
400 milligrams 4 times a day.
Mm-hmm. A couple of thoughts on that. Gabapentin is a good drug. Maximal dose is 800 milligrams 3 times a day or 2,400 milligrams a day. First thing I would do out of the box is I would go to the maximal dose of gabapentin over time. Can make you sleepy. Your body has to adjust to it. A lot of people call it, makes them a little dopey. Mm-hmm. That's what they call it. And there are a couple of other drugs on the market if that doesn't work. These are anti-epileptic drugs that often work with chronic pain and neuropathy. The two other drugs I would consider in that class are Lyrica, Lyrica, name brand drug, costs more, works a little differently, and may be useful for this. And the other one is Topamax, Topomax. And once again, if one doesn't work, you try the other one going up to the maximal dose, and if that doesn't work, you try another one going up to the maximal dose. Those are usually the drugs that we give, and usually over time, they can help. But this is a very good place where complementary and alternative medicine, acupuncture, massage therapy, aromatherapy, contrast baths can take an issue. Have you looked at going to an alternative healer for this?
Yes, I was wanting to ask, what do you think about acupuncture?
I think it may work for this. I would definitely try it.
Okay.
This is a good example where the energy channels, I pronounce it chi, but I know that's not exactly the way it's pronounced, but the energy channels that are postulated to be affected during acupuncture may really make a difference. And I would do both routes. It's not A or B. Mm-hmm. I would do acupuncture. I would also consider Tibetan medicine, because they have a number of things that they give for situations like this. This is
the
thing
natural
where
natural medicine.
Well, it's not natural. It's from herbs, what I call herbs and spices. It's from mm-hmm. it's from things that are grown that are often grown in the plateaus of Tibet, and they can be very useful. And I would consider all of this. I would do Western mm-hmm. medicine, acupuncture, and I would look towards herbal medicine because neuropathies can be awful, as you know.
It is. It's awful. It hurts all the way up, halfway up to my knees.
It can just be awful. Yeah.
It is. It's awful. Yeah. It just is like little pins and needles.
It works. Keep up the good work, and thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for letting me be on your show.
We appreciate the call. Thank you very much. Before we break, Zorba, let's see if we can help out Jake in Jacksonville, Florida. Jake is a musician who may be playing himself out of his passion. See, he plays the upright bass and says that his instrument is causing him tightness and trouble in his elbow. What should he do?
Oh, go to the violin, of course. It's much easier to carry it than you don't have
yeah,
to.
Yeah, but there's still elbow involved.
There are a couple of things. Yeah. Often this is a lateral epicondylitis, which is like tennis elbow and like golfer's elbow. Mm-hmm. It often means that what he has to do is he has to hold the bow differently and play the bass differently. You can play the same music, but you have to learn how to do that. And that often means going to a trainer or a physical therapist. Physical therapists are dynamite. He brings the bass in there. He gets a motion analysis from a physical therapist. He looks and he sees, and it's with the way you hold the bow and move the bow across the bass that can make a difference. And the other is a tennis elbow splint. And these are things that you wrap around your elbow, but around the extensor muscles that are just distal to the elbow. They can work really well.
Yeah. Okay. If a lifestyle question is preventing you from hitting all the right notes, let us help by sending us your questions to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have a yummy recipe coming up. More of your calls and questions, of course, our medical myth buster later in the hour, and some more research, all right here on Zorba Faster on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again is 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, a recipe for corn and shrimp pilaf.
Yes. I love corn. And there's certain times of the year when you can get fresh corn. And you know what? Fresh corn is wonderful.
Corn on the cob.
Fresh corn on the cob. And to take corn off of the cob turns out not to be very difficult at all. You can do it with a sharp knife, or you can go and buy one of those things that are on the internet. They're always showing, those late night things that are always showing corn, how to take corn off the cob with these corn cutters. But actually, fresh corn is great. Frozen corn will work here, but fresh corn, dynamite. Mm-hmm. Shrimp, do you love shrimp?
I like it.
You like shrimp?
Yeah.
You don't love shrimp?
No, I love my wife.
Oh, I love my wife. Oh, I love that. I love that. I hope Monica's loving it.
I don't love food.
I love my wife. No, you don't love food.
I don't
that
love
I know.
Food
that
all,
I know. Yeah. Well, I love my life. I can love my wife and love shrimp. That's it. I love my wife more than shrimp.
Okay.
Penny, I love you more than shrimp.
That doesn't count. I got in first.
You got in first.
Okay, let's
all
do
right,
the recipe.
All right, let's do the recipe. A tablespoonful. I said that correctly. Not tablespoonful.
It isn't one, it's one and a quarter.
I know, but I wanted to make sure I said it correctly for the grammar police who are always listening.
Right.
A tablespoonful and a quarter of unsalted butter.
One and a quarter, big T, unsalted butter.
I am going to enunciate this perfectly.
Good for you.
For the grammar and the enunciation, please. Three green onions, white and green parts, sliced separately.
Three green onions, white and green parts, sliced separately.
That's
I like those kind of green
that's
onions.
Right. Yeah, that's right. And if you are colorblind, try to figure it out. You can probably figure it out from the shadow, right? You can't see green if you're red-green colorblind.
Yeah.
You just know it's darker.
Oh.
You wouldn't know it's green.
Well,
you're not colorblind.
You tell the difference between green and white.
Now my father was colorblind, my father was also fashion impaired. I am not colorblind, but I am fashion impaired like my father. And we'll go into that later. Yeah. Three cloves of garlic minced.
Three cloves of garlic minced.
Okay. Teaspoon of red pepper flakes.
One little tea red pepper flakes.
Half teaspoon of cumin seed.
A half a little tea cumin seed.
I want to talk a little bit about cumin. Buy cumin in either an Asian grocery store or a Mexican grocery store, and it will cost one quarter as much as in your regular grocery store. Mm-hmm. I am shocked at the markup of cumin in every regular grocery store I go to, and I am shocked at how cheap cumin is in Mexican grocery stores.
How much does it cost in a regular store?
It's like $4 a bottle.
And how much does it cost in the other store?
89 cents.
And how much gas do you use trying to find
it's
the
right
other store?
It's right on the way to where I'm going.
Okay.
Get a life. We're always looking for a bargain.
Right.
It comes in my nature.
Okay.
A cup of white rice.
A cup of white rice.
That's right. We won't go into that. A half cup of dry white wine.
Half a cup of dry white wine.
And as you know, I use vermouth.
I use
Gallo vermouth because I like the taste of Gallo vermouth, and I use that in all my white wine recipes, and it works wonderfully and it lasts for a long time.
And because it's cheap.
And it's cheap. That's right. Mm-hmm. And Consumer Reports or Cook's Illustrated once did a taste test with a number of things that use white wine, and they used Gallo vermouth, and it came out right on top. One 15-ounce can of veggie broth.
A 15-ounce can of vegetable broth?
That's right. If you can get the low sodium, better to get it, especially with the veggie broth. And the reason is there's more broth and taste in the low sodium broths. The same, by the way, is true of chicken broth. Mm-hmm. There's more chickeny flavor because they don't have the salt to mask that flavor, or rather amplify it. Mm-hmm. A one cup of, if you can, fresh corn kernels.
a cup of fresh corn kernels.
That's right. Try saying that 10 times. Corn kernels, corn kernels, fresh corn. Frozen are okay, but not as good.
Yeah.
8 ounces of uncooked large shrimp peeled, and if you want to devein them, do it. I never spend the time.
Hmm. 8 ounces of uncooked large shrimp peeled. And
that's
deveined.
Right. And deveined if and you want deveined, to. Do you devein your shrimp when you have
every
shrimp?
Time.
Every time. See, it doesn't bother me. I know how much you cook. So I can't really believe that. 2 tablespoonfuls of cilantro.
2 big tea cilantro.
And you can, if you don't want to put that in, it's okay. Some people do not like the taste of cilantro. In that case, use parsley. Mm-hmm. Use parsley, and Italian parsley is what I'd use. Lemon wedges.
Lemon wedges.
Salt and pepper to taste.
S&P.
Let's make the recipe. Mm-hmm. Heat 1 teaspoon of butter over medium heat in a saucepan. Add the white portions of the green onions, garlic, red pepper, and cilantro to the saucepan and stir for a minute or two. Then add the rice and stir for an additional minute. So you're adding the rice to this buttery mixture. And that's a very important thing about pilaf, in the fact that rice is sauteed before the rice basically puffs up. Otherwise, it's not a pilaf. Mm. Add the white wine. Boil for 1 more minute until the liquid is almost absorbed into the rice. Reduce the heat and cover. Cook until the rice is tender, about 12 minutes. Mm-hmm. Then add the corn, shrimp, cilantro, and the remaining butter to the rice. Cook and cover until the rice are cooked, about another 5 minutes. Season with salt and pepper. Spoon into bowls. Sprinkle with the green portion of the green onions and garnish with the lemon wedge. Now, this is a wonderful recipe. And you know what we're missing?
What?
Adam. We're missing Adam because Adam decided that he wasn't actually going to make this recipe. And the reason is, I just learned today, Adam doesn't like seafood.
No, he doesn't.
He doesn't like seafood. Yeah. I mean, I'm absolutely shocked. Yeah. I mean, here he is. But he's got the taste of an epicure.
Yeah.
He's got the, if you will, the esprit de corps of a gourmet, and he doesn't like seafood.
Yeah, but
he's
I don't care about
seafood.
That. He's the executive producer, and part of the executive producer's job is cooking the meal for
that's
us,
for,
whether he likes
for,
it or not.
For the talent.
That's right.
The executive. The talent. Is supposed to cook the seafood for the talent, and we don't have that.
And his particular taste shouldn't matter
at all. It shouldn't matter at all. Not at
whether
least.
Whether you so and I like it.
That's what really counts. So Adam loses points on this show. I mean, you know, he loses points. Anyway, 254 calories per serving. It's a great recipe. It's low fat. It's dynamite. It contains seafood. And for the talent, it's a delicious meal. And if you want a copy of the meal, come to our website at zorbapastry.org, and you can look on that website. You can find other wonderful recipes, and you can sign up for our weekly podcast. That's zorbapastry.org.
One 800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. 800-462-7413. Back to the phones now, Zorba, and a listener with us in Newton, Kansas. Hi.
Hi there.
How can we help you?
Well, here about 3 months ago, my wife got a bite on her leg. The bite continued to get larger and larger, and it had a red ring around the outside of it. It was like red in the middle, and then a white stripe, and then a red stripe. She went to the doctor. She wasn't feeling well, and they tested her for Lyme disease. Now, the test came back, and it said equivocal. And it said on there that the CDC recommended that she get a Western blot. Equivocal, I guess, is the middle range. She went and had the Western blot. It came back equivocal as well. And they also tested for rheumatoid arthritis because she was suddenly having really bad problems with her joints. She was tired all the time. She sleeps a lot, really out of sorts. My concern is we've had 2 of these Western blots done now, which apparently they use that to test a lot of different things, and they come back, the first one came back as it had tested for HIV-1, the second one came back with results for West Nile, and they've got her going to a rheumatoid specialist, and my concern is there a possibility that it is actually Lyme disease? How long does it take, you know, to determine if it is Lyme disease? She seems to have symptoms, from what I've read on the internet, of Lyme disease. I'm not sure where to go from here.
Yeah. Before we answer, Zorba, help us with some terms. Equivocal and Western blot.
Well, first of all, Western blot is just a type of blood test. So just think of it that way. It's not.
And what is the result, equivocal?
Equivocal mean maybe. Sometimes things are maybe. Sometimes they're in a gray zone. Yeah. So let's talk about Lyme disease.
Yeah.
And let's kind of relate it to a cervical cancer. It's a good example. A woman goes in, gets a pap test. The pap test is abnormal. That doesn't mean she has cervical cancer at all. The way to tell whether or not she has a cervical cancer, among other things, is to go and do something called a colposcopy. They take a biopsy of the cervix, and that's the exact test. Mm-hmm. But you don't do that with every woman that tests for cervical cancer because, A, it's too expensive, B, it's invasive, a bunch of other reasons. So when we look for Lyme disease, we do an initial test that says, hey, maybe this is Lyme disease. Maybe, maybe, yes or no. That can be equivocal. And then we do the secondary test, which is much more exact. And that, in this case, is called a Western blot test. It's the type of test. That's all it is. Now, when that comes back equivocal, what you do is you recheck it again 2 to 4 weeks later usually, or it might be 4 to 6 weeks later. There's a very specific time period. And the reason is it's measuring antibodies to the Lyme bug. That's what it's doing. And so you may get equivocal, and if it's positive, it's going to show up 4 to 6 weeks later. And in the meantime, if you're concerned, you treat the person for Lyme disease, which basically is a 2-week course of antibiotics. I mean, that is the treatment.
Well, don't these symptoms suggest that there is
Lyme? Oh, you can have Lyme disease. It could be rheumatoid arthritis. The rash sounds like it's the rash of Lyme disease. What you've described is the rash of Lyme disease, but that doesn't mean you have Lyme disease. I mean, even if it sounds like the rash, the Western blot test is really the test to determine it. The rash is not specific enough to actually make the diagnosis. Now, if they tested her for other things, that means she didn't actually have a Lyme, didn't actually look like Lyme disease to them. Sounds like, well, maybe you've got rheumatoid arthritis. That's a clinical diagnosis and a laboratory test. There's no lab test that shoves it in or shoves it out. Rheumatoid arthritis, it's a combination of laboratory testing and clinical diagnosis, so it's not an exact thing. Let's get back to the Lyme disease. Did she get a course of antibiotics?
They started her initially on the antibiotics that I guess they give for somebody with Lyme disease. Mm-hmm. And then when that didn't seem to be helping, they switched her to another. They weren't sure if it was a tick bite or if it might have been a bite from like a brown recluse.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So they switched her antibiotics and had her on another course of antibiotics. Her concern is the fact that she suddenly, out of the blue, for the last 3 months, has had severe joint pain.
Well, the real issue, the bottom line issue is this. You have a rheumatologist on your team?
She's seeing one today, actually.
That's the important thing. What you need is you need a rheumatologist to sort this out. Lyme disease is really an arthritic condition. Rheumatoid arthritis, an arthritic condition. Lyme disease may be infectious in origin, but it's really a rheumatological condition. You want to think of it that way. You need a rheumatologist to sort out what the joint pain is from. It's not clear to me either. And sometimes you need a second opinion to do this too. It's clear to me that she had a rash, she had equivocal tests, and now she has joint pain. That's what's clear, but it's not clear what's doing it. Now, one other suggestion. In complicated cases where a doc can't figure it out, this is where I think a reference second opinion from 100 miles away, often at a university setting or a place like Mayo Clinic, a big clinic, can be very, very helpful. So if your local rheumatologist doesn't have the answer, that's where you go somewhere else to get another opinion, because sometimes you have to go to somebody who sees all the unusual ducks that are out there, mm-hmm. and they're more likely to pick up what it is because your wife has a cloudy picture.
Okay.
Thank you and good luck. Let us know what happens.
Thanks very much. I will.
We appreciate the call. And before we close out the segment, Zorba, let's bounce over to the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox for another quick question. This question comes to us from Martin, who is trying to stay out of the proverbial doghouse with his wife. He writes, I have a serious problem to deal with. My wife tells me that throughout much of the night, I twitch and sometimes jerk severely while I sleep. That keeps her awake. She is threatening to put me outside with the dogs at night. Can you tell me what might cause this and how I can avoid it?
You know, sometimes we, you know, we twitch and we move around. There's restless leg syndrome, which, you know, it basically decreases these type of movements. And if it's really bothersome to the other person, there are two things to look at. Number one, are there meds that are doing it? Believe it or not, certain medications, including Lipitor, can cause you to twitch and move around and cause night terrors, almost like night terrors, where you start to move around with your body and you hit the other person. And I have actually two patients who had that. They stopped their statin drug and it goes away. So are the drugs causing it? And if not, I would go to a drug called Requip, R-E-Q-U-I-P, which is a Parkinson-like drug, and it stops these sort of autonomous movements that happen and produce this. And that's what I would look for. Mm-hmm. And if that doesn't work, you know, switch marriages. Get a different wife.
Stay with the same wife, but just let her know that you don't want to bother the dogs at night.
You know? There you go. Yeah. There you go.
They have a right to sleep well at night. If you're on the verge of Sofa City, let Zorba help you get back to bed.
Sofa
just send your
City.
Questions to the show in an email to
Zorba at WPR.org.
Some interesting research to talk over. We have more of your calls as well. And, of course, our medical myth buster later on, right here on Zorba Pasture on Your Health from PRI Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pasture here on Zorba Pasture on Your Health. That number again is 800-462-7413. But, Zorba, before our next call, bad news for fish oil.
Bad news for fish oil. Let's talk about this study. I think the study is an interesting study. Fish oil. So what do we know about fish? We know that people who eat fish have fewer heart attacks and strokes. That's what we know.
Right.
And study after study has shown fish once or twice a week. So we, in a typical American way, say, well, maybe it's the fish oil because fattier fish seems to be better. And fish oil seems to lower triglycerides. There is an approved FDA drug called Lavoza, which actually is a fish oil that has been proven not to reduce heart attacks, but actually reduces triglycerides, which are a heart attack risk factor. Here's the study. Margarine. People got all the margarine they wanted to. Some margarine had no fish oil. Some margarine had omega-3 fatty acids from fish oil. Some had omega-3 fatty acids from plants, from nuts. And some had omega-3 fatty acids in them hardly at all. And then they followed. These were heart attack victims, nearly 5,000 heart attack victims between the ages of 60 and 80, and they followed them for 3 years. And guess what?
Well, my guess is that the fish oil didn't seem to make any difference.
Didn't do a thing.
Yeah. But,
didn't do a thing.
But there's a whole lot about this study. The fish oil in a slice of margarine on a slice of bread is nowhere near the kind of fish oil that people take in those huge capsules.
Well, it's very interesting. There were a number of people who commented on it, including Mayo Clinic doctors who said it was too little, too late.
Yeah.
This is after people actually had a heart attack and it was very middle and the doses are small. And so the study has no meaning at all. And they may be right, but I've seen this time and time and again. I've seen it with things like vitamin E.
Yeah.
We know that people eat nuts, that nuts are healthy, and then we take out vitamin E and we say vitamin E is good, and then all the vitamin E research shows it doesn't prevent heart attack, strokes, or Alzheimer's. We've seen it with folic acid. We've seen the folic acid doesn't reduce heart attacks and strokes. We've seen it with a variety of other things. So what we like to do is we like to take one chemical out, beta-carotene, another good example. Turns out carrots have 13 different kinds of beta-carotene, so we take one out. So the bottom line for this is fish oil may not be cracked up, but I think they're right. It might be too low a dose. On the other hand, fish is good.
Right.
And so if you want to take fish oil and you think you're going to get the benefits of fish from fish oil, think again.
It would be a little better test, though, if they'd put some neutral thing in those big pills and had half the people taking
that. Well, they do. There are other studies that are looking at. But the study that looked at fish oil that's FDA approved still didn't show reduction in heart attacks and strokes. That study still didn't show it. So the bottom line is Mother Nature knows best. And there's other stuff in fish that really makes a difference. So I look at this as one point for Mother Nature, zero for pharma.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. A caller with us now, Zorba in Manitowoc, Wisconsin. Hello.
Hi.
What's up?
Well, here's my question. I have been a longtime blood donor. I've been doing it for many years. And recently I went in to donate, and one of the workers there asked me if I would be willing to donate. Now, I don't remember if they said either plasma or platelets.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of wavered on it, and the person who was asking me this question said, well, you don't have to commit to anything now. We'd have to check you out first anyway. You'd have to give us a sample, and we'd have to test it to make sure that you that your blood products would be acceptable. So I said, all right, it's not going to hurt anything just to do the test. Well, they tested me, and then I was informed that I am not eligible to donate the anything other than whole blood, that apparently there's some antibody, the way they phrased it was, directed toward white blood cells that could cause problems for the recipient of my blood. And they told me in this letter that it's no big deal, you don't have to be worried about it, that this is a relatively common occurrence among women who have been pregnant before, which I have. So just, go on with things, but we won't take your blood other than whole blood. Now, I'm just wondering, how does this occur? And also, does this mean that I will never be able to donate platelets or plasma? Or is this maybe an antigen or an antibody, rather, in my blood that would subside over time?
Good questions, by the way. Excellent questions. And I can really give you an answer. First of all, here it is. You volunteer. You go to the Red Cross. We're testing it. And then they go, no, we don't want to have you. That never feels really very good. You want to have the most pristine blood in the world and say, hey, you've got great blood. We want to take your blood and everything else. What happens during birthing of a child is that there can be a mixture of bloods, and then you can develop some antibodies. And what they did was they picked up one of the antibodies that obviously does not interfere with blood, with whole blood, but interferes with either plasma or platelets. And I don't know which one, but in both cases, those are separate blood products. So, first of all, I wouldn't be concerned about this from a health point of view at all. It just means you've got some antibodies to one of your, how many children did you have?
I've had two.
Two kids. So you've got some antibodies to some of the blood products that basically got exchanged somewhere during the pregnancy. The placenta keeps the baby's blood separate from you, but sometimes there can be some leakage. So no harm, no foul from your point of view. And I think, hey, you're doing this because you're helping other people.
Mm-hmm.
And you can help other people in the way that you feel most comfortable. And that's giving whole blood, and that's wonderful. And I would just continue doing that.
It kind of worked out just great then, because I wasn't really warm to the idea of giving the plasma in the first place, and here my decision's been made for me. So.
It's been made for you, and you can continue to do it. And what happens is they test your blood against the blood of the other person, and if your antibodies will affect that other person's blood, they don't give that to that person, they give it to someone else. And that's why the blood banks in various areas communicate with each other, and they'll say, hey, I have a blood here with this antibody, and they'll say, oh, we have a patient here who won't respond to that antibody, and that person gets the blood. So congratulations on doing this. We need more people to give blood. It's always, always, always a problem because we have no artificial blood. We can just get it from each other, frankly. So I congratulate you on doing that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Appreciate the call. Thank you. 800-462-7413. And Zorba, time now for our medical myth buster. Today's myth is dedicated to our third shift workers. Normally, we help folks out with falling to sleep, but what if you need that extra jolt to keep you going throughout the overnight shift? Is caffeine the best solution?
Well, the answer is caffeine is the best solution. And I want to go back just a little bit in history. I want to go back to 1600, okay? 1600, the Dutch came in and founded New Amsterdam, which is New York. And they introduced coffee into the colonies at that time because they found a brisk cup of coffee in the morning, which we're still doing, is useful. And guess what the New Englanders at that time were having as their morning beverage? Now you're probably going to guess tea, right? That they're sitting down with a cup of tea, right?
I don't know what my guess would be, actually.
The answer is rum. The New Englanders actually had a glass of rum in the morning when they actually started their day versus a glass of coffee. Who was more efficient, the Dutch versus the New Englanders? Mm. Now, looking at coffee, coffee and caffeine is wonderful. And for years, people, the anti-caffeine lobby, which basically are the Puritans, have tried to say coffee is bad. They've tried to link it to cancer. It's not. They've tried to link it to cardiac arrhythmias of the heart to cause sudden death. It's not. Mm-hmm. They've tried to link it to ulcers. It's not. It turns out that coffee is even useful to possibly help prevent diabetes. Now, the question is, does it wake you up at night for night shift workers? And the answer is yes. The Cochrane Library recently came up with a review that looked at night shift workers who really have a problem with error rates, doctors in the hospital, policemen and so on. And they discovered that when they did a double-blind study and they gave people caffeine capsules versus placebos, there were fewer errors made throughout the entire night shift if they had caffeine. So the answer is, when it comes to coffee at night, it rocks.
Yeah. There are pills, too, that probably aren't as good for you.
No, I don't know. No dose. Well, I think it's okay. I mean, it's a pill. If you don't like coffee, get it through no dose. There's no difference. Yeah. No, it's a caffeine tablet. But I like mine in a shot. Shot of espresso. That's what makes me go.
And not rum.
Not rum. No, I do have my rum, but not when I want to stay up.
If you have a myth keeping you up and need us to bust it, send it to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
800-462-7413, toll free. And Zorba, a listener with us now in Hoover, Alabama. Hi.
Howdy.
How can we help?
First of all, I like the name Zorba Pastor. You think you're a religious figure, but...
Thank you very much. That would be Pastor Zorba if I were a religious figure.
Yeah, right.
I thought you were trying to be modern there. But anyhow, I have... I keep getting ingrown toenails on my toes, and my nails are kind of funky looking. They kind of point up, if you will. I keep getting ingrown toenails, especially on my big toe on my left foot. And what has happened is that it'll get ingrown, get a little bit infected. It never puffs up really big or anything. And then I go get it cut out and take antibiotics and everything's fine. Well, this one I have not gone to get cut out. It's been about 8 or 9 months, maybe longer. My leg has started to tingle and almost get hot sometimes, then it'll tingle some more. But anyhow, I weigh about 270. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if there's, an infection issue, or is it weight and, the toe thing, or is it just weight that will make my leg tingle?
But just out of curiosity, you've had these things treated before. Why did you decide not to have this one treated?
I have a computer business, and I haven't taken the time to go to the doctor to get it treated.
Oh, sure. Now, when you say you had it, did you have the whole nail removed? Is that what you did, went to a doctor's office and had the whole nail removed?
No, I always get it cut out, and when he offered to just deaden the nail so it wouldn't grow back, I said no because I was scared it's going to look bad. And so I keep just getting it cut out to, he'll cut about a third of it out or half and then, bandage it up. So
how many times have you had it cut out in total?
I don't know, 4 or 5 times.
That's a lot of that. That is a lot of times. Ingrown toenails are actually puffy skin. I mean, the nail, we think of the nail as growing in, but actually it's the skin that grows out. It's the other way of looking at it. And for most people, it's due to trauma, bumping into a shoe. Very common in a young male and female soccer players because their toe goes all the way to the end and essentially bumps into the end of the shoe. And so that's a problem. But you're a computer operator. You're not a soccer player.
I used to rock climb a lot, and I think that's what...
Absolutely, probably is what set this off. That absolutely is it. And when you take the nail out, what you do is you give it plenty of time to grow back, and during that time, the skin depuffs, if you will, and the nail is better. But if this has happened 3 or 4 or 5 times, I'd get the whole thing removed and I'd get the nail bed removed. Now, the problem is, of course, you then don't have any nail. And that does look funny. I mean, people do notice it. They'll go, hey, what happened to your nail? So it depends on whether or not you can live without a nail on there. We don't need our toenails for anything. You know, they're a vestigial organ, if you will, on the toes. So they don't, I mean, we don't use our toes for anything. But anyway, so you might want to consider getting rid of the nail. I think the tingling and the numbness may be related to that. Could be related to weight, could be related to a shoe that's too tight, but I doubt it. I think it's an outside chance. I think if you've got that, it could be related to it. I mean, I certainly will lose 10 or 20 pounds, but I think I'd get that nail taken out permanently. As long as you don't mind cosmetically how it looks, get rid of the nail. That's what I would do.
All right.
Okay.
Appreciate the call. Now, you know, Zorba, the toe bone is connected to the foot bone. The foot bone is connected to the shin bone. The shin bone is connected to the knee bone.
There you
knee
go.
Knee bone connected to the thigh
there
bone.
You. I got it.
The
I got it, Tom. I got it, Tom.
Neck bone
I got it, Tom.
Connected to the cheek.
I got it, Tom. I got it, Tom. And that's how you get the cheek in there.
And besides,
with your foot. Besides, you're always scratching your cheek with your toes. Everyone is doing that.
Well, before we check out here, Zorba, for the week, it's time for another citation from the Zorba Pastor on Your Health Grammar Police. But this one is really more just a warning, or better yet, really an explanation, and I think kind of an interesting one. As part of your advice, you often tell some of our listeners to Google such and such, and then proceed to explain to me that Google is a verb. Well, Deputy Chris out of the Kewaunee, Wisconsin Bureau of the Grammar Police wants to set the record straight. Chris writes, I remember learning about the word Google in the mid-80s in a math class. It is a 1 with 100 zeros following it. Although what it has come to mean in the zeitgeist is different. It was a word that existed pre-internet era. However, in your defense, our producer Adam has just Googled the word Google and discovered that while the word is pronounced the same, the mathematic version is spelled G-O-O-G-O-L.
That's right. That's exactly it. It's spelled differently. And when I was a kid, I learned about it. There was the Google and the Googleplex. And the Google was one, I think, what did we say, 100 zeros after it?
1,000.
1,000 zeros yeah. after it. And a Googleplex.
I'm sorry. With 100 zeros.
With 100 yeah, zeros. Yeah. That's a Google. But a Googleplex, the number of zeros would stretch from here to the moon if you wrote it down. And I remember as a kid, it was a funny number. And that's right. It's spelled differently.
Yeah.
But I think it's important for public radio listeners to know the derivation of Google. But Google is now a homonym, right?
Okay.
The math Google is a homonym.
Okay.
The math Google is a homonym.
Talk to you after the show. If Google can't answer your lifestyle questions, we bet Zorba can. Just send them along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
Don't forget you can call us anytime at 800-462-7414. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's produced by Adam McNulty Friedrich and Brad Bunk Kohlberg. Adam Friedrich is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark. Going to learn right after the show what homonym is. I should know. In any case, stay with us. Be with us next time here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0924Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.